67 or 67 or 68, there will be the fourth assembly of the World Council. We will finish up the historical part and then begin to examine and explore the broad theological premises. What I want to do, as I think you are seeing, in the ecumenical movement is what we've done with the four main streams of Protestantism. First, give you a brief historical rundown of the whole movement, then analyze the big thematic issues of the ecumenical movement, and then examine the documents that we've got in our text, plus some that I will give to you before the course is over. So we'll cover the history, then we'll begin taking the big theological issues. The most significant historical phenomenon in the ecumenical movement of the last 40 years has been the interest and involvement of Roman Catholicism in what had been going on for a century, as we saw before. The change has been not only significant, it has, I'd say, considerably revised ecumenical premises. It is clear from the beginning, as we said, that the Catholic Church was invited, and not only invited, you might say, verbally, but as one of the speakers at the assembly in Amsterdam said, we cannot effectively solve the problem of Christian disunity until, and I'm quoting a Protestant theologian, until the Mother of Church of the West is involved in our proceedings. The response had been, first of all, Pius XI's encyclical, Mortalium Animos, in 28. Then of Pius XII, De Motione Ecumenica, which I believe is 48 or 49, is it? And then the modern development of the Second Vatican Council under John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. Now, we will not spend time here delineating the implications of the Second Vatican in terms of the ecumenical movement. That we'll save, as you'll notice by your roadmap, for the end, mainly in the reactions of both the Protestant and the Orthodox communions to the Vatican Council. Sufficient here to note a few developments, both under John and Paul. The first, of course, was one of the main intentions for organizing the council in the first place was to solve the problem of Christian disunity. It is a safe statement to say or to make that historically there would have been no Second Vatican Council had there not been a preceding ecumenical movement. In other words, the atmosphere, more than atmosphere, the ground had been changed or softened or seeded, whatever figure you want to use, for a responsive consideration of the whole problem of disunity by the almost 100 years of negotiations, from all the way back to the mid-19th century among Protestants, later on the Orthodox, and finally the Catholics. Secondly, implementing this desire to do something about the ecumenical movement, or better, to join it, that's what it comes to. The Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, means the Catholic Church has joined the ecumenical movement. It may no longer by Catholics, by any stretch of the imagination, be called a non-Catholic movement. It is not, it never was, even though the prime movers of the ecumenical movement have not been members of the Catholic Church. It is now, to all intents and purposes, a pan-Christian movement in which all major Christian bodies are involved. To implement that, Pope John did two things, both significant and historic. First, he set up a special commission to study the problems of disunity for the Vatican Council, making it part of the, you might say, the structure of the Vatican Council. In so many words, telling the bishops, look into this. This is our problem as it is everyone else's. He put it on the agenda. Secondly, he invited, and the invitation was more than formal, he invited all the major bodies to send representatives, both of the Orthodox and of the Protestant churches, to send the representatives to the Second Vatican Council. And the representatives there were not to be mere observers. often the word observer is used. More correctly, in the documentation coming from Rome, in the basic, any Catholic interested in the Catholic idea on the ecumenical movement should keep up with this literature called Unitas, which is simply the Latin word for unity. The International Quarterly Review, the English language edition, it comes, I think, in about 5 languages, and it is published in Rome. The piece that I read to you from or about the YMCA had been published in Unitas by your teacher. I contribute about once a year or so some article to this organ. It is as official as you can make it, organ of the Catholic concern for the ecumenical movement. It is interesting to note that this is now in its 15th volume and 4th number, suggesting that this thing had antedated the Second Vatican Council by quite some years. The editor of the review of the organ is a former teacher of mine, Father Boyer, who had been the Vatican Council representative at the first assembly at Amsterdam in 1948. There are some interesting accounts of my relationship with Father Boyer over the years after having had him at a graduate course on the theology of grace in St. Augustine for a whole semester. But in Evanston in 1954, Catholics were not official representatives or official delegates. The main reason was the kind of exploitation that had been made of the Vatican participation in 48. Nevertheless, Catholics were deeply involved in Amsterdam, rather in Evanston, as I know, because I happen to be in Chicago, which is, as you know, the home city of Evanston, which is a suburb of Chicago. And among the things that I sent to Father Boyer within 3 weeks of the closing of Evanston was microfilm of all the proceedings at Evanston. Over 100 feet of microfilm of all the documentation from Evanston, which I was furnished by the delegates at Evanston in 1954. Anyhow, this is the corresponding document, or you might say review, which is like the ecumenical review that comes out of the World Council of Churches. Mike, have a question.
Will you be going, Father, in later into the Orthodox position? And
yes.
What they contributed to this?
Yes, I certainly will. Yes. So, the Second Vatican Council did first to organize the secretariat, which put it on the agenda, and second to invite the observers. These observers are correctly called observer delegates, because without having voting power, as would be understandable, they do more than observe. They contribute to the ongoing business of the council by furnishing material to the bishops. They are apprised of what's going on. They are in contact with the inner circle of the negotiations of the Vatican Council, and they have lent a very important hand to the negotiations and even to some of the documentation. So much for the Vatican Council at this stage, historically. I should add that between John and Paul, as popes, in their attitude towards the ecumenical movement, they differ as two people differ. And understandably, Pope John was, as some believe, charismatic in his charity. It seems that he made friends wherever he went, and he certainly befriended the non-Catholic world in a way that perhaps no pope ever had done, certainly in modern times. I remember talking to a Presbyterian minister one day in the Pennsylvania station in Louisville, and he said, "You'd be surprised, but our last ministerial meeting was," this is the Presbyterian meeting of a large presbytery, he said, "we were discussing," I don't know whether he used the word technique, "but the method of Pope John, the man with a positive genius for making friends, and we felt we could learn something from his methods." So Pope John was mainly concerned with, you might say, projecting the kindness and the charity, the open-handedness, if you will, the open-heartedness of Roman Catholicism with its relation to those who don't share Catholic theological principles. Had it not been for him, no doubt the council would never have been summoned. Pope Paul is not John, as no two people are alike. He is much more of an intellectual. He is a theologian. He is much more of a reflective and pensive personality. Yet, you might almost say any great movement that has ever taken place in Christianity has almost always had first a prophet and then a theologian. It seems that you just need things like that. Somebody to open up and someone to, well, get things organized and implement the insights. Pope Paul's contribution, therefore, to the ecumenical movement is and will be on a theological basis. If you've read Sarapian's book, of which I think I left a copy in the library, did I? I hope I did.
Yes, I have.
It's Sarapian, not Sarapian. Sarapian's book on the pilgrim. You notice some of the sometimes rather hard description, harsh almost, of Pope Paul in comparison with John, and vice versa too. The remark, for example, of as he said to some Roman officials, speaking of John as not knowing where love ended and dogma began. Well, certainly he was so charitable that some wrongly suspected him as not knowing enough Catholic theology. The Church would believe that the Holy Spirit would certainly enlighten him. Paul can never be accused of not being theological enough. And as a consequence, it is possible to misunderstand what some have called a slowing down process of the ecumenical movement as far as the Catholic Church is concerned. Quite the contrary. I would say this, however, as we will see, he has opened up negotiations with the Orthodox in a way that we perhaps in the United States don't appreciate, for the simple reason that Orthodoxy, even Eastern Orthodoxy, is not so important, at least by numerical standards, with less than 5 million Eastern Orthodox in the United States.
Would you elaborate that, Father? You mean opened up?
Well, opened up negotiations. His visit, for example, to Athenagoras is opening up negotiations. What I mean, there are negotiations, theological negotiations, with the Eastern Orthodox churches to get them into the ecumenical movement in a way they had not been before.
Why would you say we wouldn't understand that?
Well, I'd say at least in terms of, say, popularity or journalism. The average journalist, well, you'd probably have to look up how you spell the word Orthodox. And besides, most people in the United States are not Orthodox, and consequently the interest in this dimension of the ecumenical movement is minimal in a country like the United States. It would be highly crucial in, say, Europe. So Paul has given an Orthodox, properly understood, orientation to the ecumenical movement, which was not so visible under Pope John. And his visit and his incredible move, for example, to make a trip to the Near East to show his friendship is one of the main reasons for this leaving the Vatican. Now the developments. Just a word, because we will see them in more specialized perspective as we go along. I've got just four or five. First, theological developments in the Catholic response. They have been on a number of levels, especially, say, two or three. One, on the level of Scripture. In other words, the recognition of valid insights into biblical studies, biblical exegesis, on the part of those who are not Catholic. Now, that is a major development. In other words, that Catholic scholars, although they had been doing this, privately perhaps, yet now it becomes more than merely private. Again, in the very concept of the Church, now this, am I going to do anything? I feel disturbing somebody. In the very concept of the Church, in other words, in ecclesiology, there have been developments, and I should add that my own work in Rome, for example, anticipating, I suppose, surely knew the ecumenical movement was in the air, although at that time, not too many years ago, the Catholic Church had not been nearly as involved as it is now. But the work that I had done, especially with, say, Father Trump, who is the executive secretary of the Theological Commission of the Vatican Council, had been to study the concept, what is the meaning of the Church? faith. Who belongs to the church? Because if a person once baptized, in no matter what community, has a relationship with Christ which no one else has, see? What happens to a person through baptism? What happens to him through his profession of the Christian faith? Even though he is not professedly, say, a Catholic. The whole relationship, see, of Christian churches, in the plural, with a Catholic church, which means you find some common denominator, right, to verify and validify, as it were, the very meaning of church. That whole theology is being explored by the Vatican Council. Again, still on the level of theology, the meaning of faith, and along with faith, the concept of grace and the channels of grace. And among the valid insights, which have always been recognized in the Catholic Church, but not made nearly so explicit as now, as I have on one occasion publicly made it part of a piece that I was writing, the discovery that Pope John made that God's grace is visited on every soul born into this world, even though not Christian. See? The universality of grace and the operation of grace had always been, of course, in Catholic teaching. But between saying that on paper, see, and living it out, and pulling out the theological implications, it's quite a difference. In other words, that God operates with his grace, sometimes with great graces, even among those who are not, by Catholic standards, members of the Roman Catholic Church. As you may have read, there will be, I think, in October, the canonization is of 22 African martyrs, men who had died for the profession of their faith in Africa, I think in the late 19th century, in Uganda, no doubt because of the persecution now going on in Africa. They are martyrs to the faith under Islam. See, Mohammedanism is persecuting the church terribly in Africa. And our American press, the only word for it is a monosyllable. It's a crime. Almost a blanket of silence for political reasons. Anyhow, Christians of all denominations are being persecuted for the faith in Africa, and no doubt that's one reason why the canonization is being timed this way. Well, it's significant that along with the canonization of these 22 martyrs of the Catholic Church, there will be for the first time, we don't know just what's going to happen, but it seems some kind of public recognition by the Catholic Church will be given to, I think, 17 Episcopalians who were also martyred for the faith at the same time. That, ladies and gentlemen, is new. And what it does, at root, is recognize, you see, the operation of God's grace. For the Spirit breathes where he wills, and wherever he breathes, that we are to respect that breathing. The worship, all kinds of developments of participation of various kinds, some of which I'm sure you shared in yourselves. I don't know whether you've heard about the thing that happened in St. Louis within the last week or two, of a couple in a mixed marriage, an Episcopalian this time again, and a Roman Catholic being married, and there being an Episcopalian minister who was involved somehow in the ceremony. Well, that's also a change of pace. I should say it is such a change of pace that I know not all dioceses would do that, because I try to do that for one of my students who is an Orthodox. I won't name the diocese. And I went to visit the chancery. We had a nice long talk with the Episcopal officials, and I was told that I was ahead of my times. Well, anyhow, on the level of worship, therefore, of a cooperation among those who don't share the Catholic faith, you see, of somehow participating even in ritual practices. Thirdly, in publications. Now, this is the reason I bring this out. Of course, we could spend a week on this whole business, but I bring out publications for you to read some of them. I'll just mention a few. Ecumenical Review has on its masthead, we call that, only call this a masthead on the outside, has a boat, see, and a cross, and oikoumene. It's published in Geneva, comes out in a variety of languages, is the best, see, all-around scholarly publication on the ecumenical movement. I think it cost me $6 a year, but it's worth it. When I first began to subscribe to this thing, apparently they don't have either a big staff or something happened to my letters, because I wasn't getting the magazine, and I had sent a check. Anytime I sent a check, I wanted to make sure that I got my money's worth. So I kept writing. Then after about 2 months, I began getting letters of apology. Every time they get a letter, they probably thought it was a different person complaining that I wasn't getting a magazine. The result was I got about 3 first copies of a magazine. It's the best going. It has articles. It keeps up on what's going on. There is an ecumenical chronicle that keeps you completely up to date on what happened in the previous 3 or 4 months. Then the World Council diary of what the World Council is doing. Then a number of fine book reviews of the best ecumenical literature in most modern languages. Then a complete, and just to indicate, here is just books received on the ecumenical movement, see, in a 3-month period. You get an idea of how much is going on in the learned world. I would safely say, in a given year in the modern languages, there are, I would think, about 300 books published. That's a lot of books. They're not all great big tomes, but they're at least, they qualify to be called books.
May anyone subscribe to this?
Yes. I think so. I've never heard otherwise, but it is worth getting.
What about the Catholic publication?
Well, the Catholic publication, there are several. Unitas is the best for a number of reasons. First of all, it comes from Rome, and therefore you can be sure, how shall I put it, that you don't just have, because after all, as in any organization, so in the Catholic Church, you have, well, people who are in left field and others who are in right field. Some are just left and some are right of center. Coming from Rome, being there at the Vatican, the people who run this thing, some of whom I know personally, are deeply committed to the ecumenical movement, but they don't go off on a limb. See? And it deals above all with theology. This, I think, is also a quarterly, yes, International Quarterly Review, English language edition, and this, I'm sure, can be subscribed to anyone who is willing to pay the price. I get my copy, shall I say, free of charge, because they don't pay me for my contribution, so I figure they owe me something. There is on the outside Ecclesia Clamat ad omnes ut inserantur. The Church calls upon all to be inserted into the, you might say, well, Christ, I'm sure the rest of it is Christ. So the Church wants everyone to be united with Christ. This has articles, it has comments and documents, and above all the documents, you don't find anywhere else. And they are translated then from whatever language they were originally written. Then again, book reviews, then they have an index of articles. I might just read you, for example, a few documents, rather a few of the articles. The recent relations between the Anglicans and the Methodists in England. United States Orthodox Western Rites. The Protestant concept of the Church. Faith and Order in Montreal. The Popes of Rome and Christian East. Lutheran World Federation Assembly in Helsinki. You see? So what they do, they study whatever is going on in the ecumenical world, give you a rundown, usually get a specialist. They usually tell you or ask you what to write about. she on?
Five or six down or something, please.
She probably is one of those fancy prices. I hope not. Single copy. Isn't this typical?
Five or six down.
Annual subscription, 15 shillings. How much is 15 shillings? Is that a lot?
No, it's about $5 or $6,
isn't it?
Unfortunately, I suppose it is $5. It probably would be about $1 a copy. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, I probably could get you a rebate. I wish I could. Here's what I would think, though. By the way, this is something. While we're at it, let's just put a parenthesis in. You know, among the things in any religious situation, what do you come to except your own position, right? There are certain, you might say, coloring, certain attitudes that you've got. Well, now when you allow, however, that, see, to determine your dealings with others so that you don't, say, listen to their side, give them the benefit of what they're teaching, suspect them of being, worse than humanly speaking they are, project your own ideas into their philosophy of life, then that is technically prejudice. And especially, for example, when you will try to inhibit their free exercise, either of religion or religious profession, that surely would be prejudice. Thus against the Jews. And be it said of the Jews against Christians, as I tell every one of my Jewish audiences, and I've never been contradicted on it. So, you see the idea? Now, along publication lines, there are books of various kinds published. In the issue of the Sanity Review, I think it was June of 63, unless I'm mistaken. Did I mention this in this class? Of the Sanity Review, where a Protestant theologian and myself analyzed the most recent ecumenical publications in the English language. Each of us covered about 12 to 15 of the best titles. I think it's the June 63 on the middle of June issue of the Saturday Review. You can find in any issue of, for example, the Ider Unitas, but especially the Ecumenical Review, of the kind of publications that are coming out. There are also now, there is the beginning of a co-sponsorship of publications. And the latest, about which I've just heard 2 days ago, and I just sent my letter back, there is a Manual of Theology, Catholic and Protestant Manual of Theology, being co-sponsored by the Jesuit School of Theology for the English-speaking Jesuits in Canada and the Oberlin School of Theology, which is Protestant. It'll be a full-size publication with about, 30 to 40 articles by specialists in their respective fields. And they're just dividing the word order, wordage, by a half, giving the Catholics a half, and the Protestants a half. And it should be out, I trust, by the middle, perhaps, of next year, maybe already by next spring, certainly by the middle of 1965. I have just signed the contract for writing the articles on Church and State and Revelation for that Manual of Theology. So you see and I don't know who my opposite number is, but the degree to which this ecumenical movement, therefore, is going, where, in other words, you have a handling even of such crucial things as theology, okay, by people from both sides. Then in social relations, well, we've seen so much of it already in operation. Well, here in our own, during our institute, the very institute itself. But I'd say the most dramatic and effective evidence of ecumenical social relations has been in, say, urging, and I am told, and at least political experts say, the cooperation on this civil rights bill, which I'm told would never have been passed, given the terrific pressures, political pressures, except through the support of the churches also from the South. See? Where the politicals felt it was a safe thing to do because at least they had the Southern churches, not all of them, of course, but many on their side. And one big and the biggest, for me, the biggest single, and this is not quite social, except in the broad sense, the greatest single benefit that I foresee of the ecumenical movement, barring none, is in the field of education. first of public education, where, in spite of some of the incredible decisions of our Supreme Court, which are the result, as you know, of pressure from vocal minority groups, in spite of that, that ways will be found and are being found, okay, to communicate those fundamental religious values in which we all believe. And secondly, the development of church-affiliated education. And this, of course, is something which those who have church schools, as say many of the Lutherans, Christian Reformed, and Catholics, surely, that there is not that same prejudice against church-affiliated schools when they seek some kind of tax subsidy. The moment you mention money, of course, even the best of ecumenical relations are liable to break down. As a matter of fact, college education is at stake. The best, and this is not an exaggeration, it just happens to have worked out that way historically, the best university education in the United States is still private, church affiliated. I've taught at Western now for over 2 years. I have also taught at Kalamazoo College, on invitation from Kay, by the way, which is, as you know, Baptist affiliated. There is no comparison, and I say this, I notice this is being recorded, see, between the depth of education, see, that you can give when you've got a solid tradition behind you. See? It means that church-affiliated private education must be kept. It dare not, I'll take extra time, we'll get our 10 minutes in. It cannot be swallowed up by state education. We need state education. We need it badly. For the milling millions of our American Republic. But if ever private education, which is mainly church-affiliated, if ever that disappears, something terrible has happened to the American mind, and it is happening. For example, Harvard, which is still basically a church-affiliated, although, of course, non-denominational college, but private, church-affiliated, Harvard recently lost its head of the economics department to a state university. He was being paid $20,000, which is good salary, but not exorbitant, but good, by Harvard for heading the economics department. He was offered by a state university a contract of $40,000. And that $40,000, of course, must be paid by the taxpayers. We have just lost, I think I should stop. We will break up for 10 minutes.
There's an interesting statement made in here. The fact that there has been recently some talk about having a constitutional amendment to the effect that you could have prayer in schools and this type of thing. And it said that the churches combined together to defeat this, defeat an amendment having this prayer in schools. And that seems strange.
Well, of course, it isn't yet defeated. At least those who are promoting it say.
I think it'll never get off the ground.
Well, it may not succeed. But the church's attitude, that's right, officially. I'm both surprised and saddened at, nevertheless, I think you're right. But that I would say also possibly would be an indication of this thing still having a long ways to go. Now we get into the theology of our problem. What we're trying to do now is to begin to explore the theological dimensions of ecumenism as covering the whole of the ecumenical movement, but I would say the ecumenical movement as it developed historically. And consequently, this does not at this point take into account what is still in the offing, namely the theology that will come into existence after another 10 or 20 years, during which time the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics will have been part of it. See? This, in a way, is the heritage that has been bequeathed to the modern ecumenical movement. Here's the theology, which is largely Protestant-orientated. First, in terms of unity, after all, there could be no ecumenical movement towards reunification unless there was already some kind of, well, interchange of ideas, some kind of a unity must already be assumed. You don't truly combine things that are utterly disparate. And consequently, in theological literature, what I'm doing here, by the way, what I will be reading or giving you, not reading, is the thinking going on, especially in the World Council of Churches. And except where I will point out, the theology that I will spell out will be that pretty much of the World Council. Their first preoccupation was to discover what do we have in common? How united are we? And then, where are we still disunited? What changes and developments have still got to be made? Now, as you would expect, whatever unity is asserted must somehow be traceable to Christ. And put very simply, the theologians of the Faith and Order Commission have repeatedly, and this has become public knowledge as part of the message, as they say, of the assembly to the Christian world, the unity we have comes to us from Christ, and it is a genetic unity, meaning that we are one, we must somehow be one, because we all come from one Christ. Just as, in a correct sense, we can say we are all somehow united in spite of our many differences as human beings, because we all come ultimately, so our Christian believes, from one common pair. We are all therefore somehow brothers and sisters in Christ, in having been descended, as it were, spiritually from Him. The very name Christian is, if you will, the surname that every individual Christian holds. However, there is a denial, it must be, of course, of there being a unity which is from Christ on a sociological level. So while there is a unity which comes from Christ, there is lacking a unity in Christ among those who now call themselves Christians. Now maybe that's stating the obvious. Well, so be it, it's the obvious. Now there are some, as we will see when we examine this in more detail, who deny the very possibility, some extremists in the ecumenical movement, who deny the very possibility of ever achieving that kind of sociological unity in which people not only would say, well, all right, we all come from the same Christ, but we are also united among each other. See, it's one thing to say I derive from Christ vertically. It's another thing to say that I hold things in common with my fellow Christian. There are some who deny we can never, the Christian world will ever be so united as to say, really, ultimately profess the self-same faith, worship in the same way, and above all, ever conceivably, be governed, the very word, by a common authority. But between the extremes of those who look forward to some kind of even ultimate organic unity on a sociological level and those who deny its very possibility, you have all the whole spectrum, you see, of the ecumenical movement. But the denial that such unity now exists, well, that everybody would admit. In fact, you don't have that unity, the, if you will, intermembral unity among the members. Now, the moment you say member, you imply some kind of unification. All right, we're all members of Christ, but we're not united among ourselves. Consequently, where they speak, as they do speak, of operating or working towards unity, there is a hidden, or perhaps sometimes not so hidden, assumption, which it is well, I think, for both Catholics and Protestants to recognize. This was the main grievance, or misgiving, I should say, that Pius XI had when he published in 28 his encyclical, which is very intransigent on this business of the ecumenical movement. There is hidden, at least in, if you will, the heritage of the ecumenical movement up to modern times, the premise that Christ did not really found a church. He started something going, which is in the process of formation, He may therefore be said to have initiated a movement. He may, if you will, be said to have founded a church which is still in the making. Now, once you say that, you've said a lot. Because then, in no conceivable sense, could the ecumenical movement be described as somehow a return to a restoration of the past. You don't want to restore the past. The past is the infancy, the childhood at most, see, of Christianity. And what looks like it is dismemberment really is a misnomer. It isn't as though something previously united had become disintegrated, but that there never had been a truly united Christianity. We now only have, you might say, or have had more severe growing pains in this process of unification. The term, therefore, that is used, and was used as a matter of fact in the Faith and Order Commission's report to the Evanston Assembly in 54, was that the unity of the ecumenical movement is eschatological. It's a big word, but has a lot of meaning. Taken literally, it's defeatism. See? Because taken literally, the eschata, the last things, the final things, come after this life. So that, as it were, all through human existence, give the human race another, not 1,936 years, but 6,391 years, it will still be in the process of a closer approximation of unity, but never really becoming one united church. In fact, it never will. That, of course, is extreme. And Wissertuf, who I think was at one time sympathetic with this idea, he now in his writing, something that I've read about him, or by him, he said he had to say those things to get the proper support. He said if we had begun talking about organic merger, organic union in Christ, of a mystical body that is realizable, if not in our own lifetime, at least, say, in the foreseeable human future, well, a lot of people would have never have joined us in the first place. So we had to do the best that we could. He is now very critical of those who say that we should think only in terms of this eschatological unity. Because, you see, unity means a church, doesn't it? It means one body. He said these people, instead of using the ecumenical movement as a stimulus to unite the Christian world, use it as a narcotic to drug it into inactivity. Now, by inactivity, he means theological inactivity. See? All kinds of backslapping and all kinds of handshaking. Brotherhood this and brotherhood that. See? But never going beneath the surface of what really divides the Christian world. Okay? Now, this is Wissertuft, who is the mastermind, you know, at least the modern ecumenical movement. See? But as I say, this must be known as being there. And what we read yesterday from, say, the Constitution of the Y, remember, YMCA, what we read even from the Constitution of the World Council of Churches, you see, almost forswearing any kind of effort, see, in the World Council of Churches to do anything else but have, you might say, some kind of consultative function. Well, things are changing. And I would say the evidence of their changing is the simple fact that the Roman Catholic Church is deeply interested in the ecumenical movement. And all you've got to do is read side by side Pius the 11th and Pius the 12th, some 20 years separating those two documents, and you see what has happened. Yet that is still there. What I mean is it has never outgrown this concept of an eschatological unity, which is sometime in the near distant future, in fact, maybe never. Now, why? This is in terms of what is being sought, what actually is had. In each one of the major assemblies, and even whenever they have committee meetings of the Faith and Order Commission, they regularly speak, and should, of course, about the existing unities, so to speak, among Christian bodies, even now. The three levels on which unity is said to be had, and this, by the way, you see immediately, color certain things that people in working for Christian unity should be aware of. The first as regarding baptism, the second the Eucharist, and the third the Bible. Now, all of this may in a sense be identified with Christ, with a common devotion to Christ. But more in detail, all Christian bodies somehow recognize baptism, though they differ widely on its necessity, meaning, and value. Eucharist, the same way. And the Bible, also. Nevertheless, baptism is commonly practiced. So is the Eucharist. And certainly in the Protestant tradition, the Bible is certainly used. Now, having said that, you begin to see, for example, the value of the Bible as a bridge for Christian reunification. And of those, like Roman Catholics, who in many ways had, without saying they neglected the Bible, a Catholic priest uses the Bible a lot. More, I'd say, per day than the average Protestant minister. He's got his mass, which he says, he has his office, which he decides, which is mainly the Scriptures. However, as far as popularizing the use of the Bible, there are, if you don't know, revolutionary things going on now in the Catholic Church towards use of the Bible, understanding it, and making it part of one's whole daily life system. And, of course, on both sides. And therefore, this is some kind of what they call realized unity. Now, to the disunity, which, of course, is the backbone of the ecumenical movement. No sense in ecumenizing unless you've got something to unite. Is there disunity? There is. What kind of disunity is there? First, on a theological level, and what we're going to do here is just give you the broad bases, then we'll take up each individual major document of the ecumenical movement. First, as far as theological origins go, how, in other words, did the churches get disunited in the first place? Now, the claim is, and I think it's a valid one, that if we can come to appreciate how this disunity came about, why the dismemberment, why the divisions, if we can retrieve the past, supply what the past perhaps should have had, in fact should have had, and if there had been that, would not have caused disunity, we have some hope for the future. Theologically, the first reason, the first premise was, and this of course was common, especially to the breach with Rome at the time of the Reformation, to purify the gospel. In other words, believing that the Christian faith is basically founded on the Scriptures, where there had been an adulteration of the gospel message with teaching of various kinds, for example, the whole business of good works, of saint worship, Mass as an act of propitiation, all kinds of things which, as you know, were the polemic of the Reformation, that understandably, naturally, there should not have been a disunity. Well, then there would not or should not have been that adulteration of the gospel. And secondly, usurpation, human usurpation of divine prerogatives. Now this applies both, or would apply both, to the reasons, I'm giving the theological reasons, as found in the literature of the ecumenical movement. Both the theological reason for the breach of Protestantism in general with Roman Catholicism, and then within Protestantism of all kinds, as we've seen, time and again, of denominations. See, the moment you use the plural, denominations, you are implying something which should be recognized. Divisions within Protestantism Because that, if we didn't say it before, let's say it now, that was and still is the major preoccupation of the Protestant side of the ecumenical movement. Now, both on the level of Protestantism's breach with Catholicism, and among the Protestant churches, where new ones arose, it was because it was claimed that somehow human beings usurped rights or privileges that belong only to God. Thus, saveth the power of the keys, familiar term, as regarding the priestly powers asserted and claimed surely by Roman Catholicism, of a person's having to confess his sins as a condition for forgiveness, of a person's receiving indulgences through the largesse, as it were, of the church, of the church's control, as Calvin said, over matrimony. Okay. Then, once Protestantism arose, there were the Puritans, to illustrate one, or the free churches on the continent, who said equivalently the same thing against their Protestant forebears, which their reformers said against the Catholic Church. What right does a synod have to dictate to me? Who is this Bischoff, say, in Germany? Who's he? Where does he get his rights? Hence the free church movement arose. The nonconformists, separatists, see? And you have, therefore, a denominationalizing of a church or of a system, Protestant Christianity, which first arose as a protest, basically, to man's usurping the place of God. See? Now, this has all sorts of avenues to it. We'll see some of it when we handle the documentation, at least the basic premises. But now, something which is not usually found, at least in the official documentation, I mean the messages which are usually 2,000 or 3,000 words long, short, crisp, and often and usually theological things, the non-theological factors. Why bring this up? Well, I'm doing more than bringing it up, because it's crucial. The reason is because for most people who are not theologians, and even for those who are professional theologians, their contribution, whether individually or through their teaching and influence on others, their contribution to the ecumenical movement will be pretty much on this non-theological level, as it were. See? What are the things that divide us? And what can we do about them? Now, studies are constantly being made by the World Council, by specialists within the ecumenical movement, to find out what are the non-theological factors. Because if they're removed, theology has a chance. If they're not, all the theological symposia will be useless. Because the moment you get back to the grassroots, the pastor makes a trip to Los Angeles, attends a summit meeting of theologians, he comes back to Paducah, Kentucky. Unless the disunitive factors back in Paducah have somehow been dealt with, his theology is worse than lost. He's liable to lose his job because he won't know what he's talking about. Now, what are these factors? This, by the way, is a course by itself. And in Geneva, where the World Council has its headquarters, they have, as you can imagine, regular school going on constantly. And I would like to see more Catholics involved. To the best of my knowledge, only one Catholic has gone through that school completely and ended up by getting his doctorate from the University of Geneva. He is Father Duff, a Jesuit. Well, spent 5 years. But he tells me, and we've talked about this, it's just priceless. They have classes there, and these are the things they study. Tuition, by the way, is low, and I'm told that it costs a number. And the beautiful Swiss scenery. Once you see the Alps, you want to go back. That is non-theological. This here, more than doctrine, divides the churches. Is that what it said? Yes. Here's what it has across. This is the World Council publication. National antagonisms, distrust of the unfamiliar, revivalism, historic isolation, reaction against compulsion, discrimination, habit, sentiment, vested interests, political pressures, institutional pride, mental limitations, unkind cut, sociology, race, indifference, property ownership, prejudices, doctored history, economics, low status quo, misrepresentations, war, personal ambition. How to wait. Ladies and gentlemen, how to? That's what divides anybody, including churches. So these are the factors, and this. Without this, we're in the clouds. We're on cloud nine, as I've heard people say. Now first, the non-theological factors that have caused divisions. Divisions here are on two levels. First, as between the major communions in Christianity, then within those communions themselves. Now I will read what this has, and this is the fruit of years of study, and just a word or two of comment, because there's just too much. First, factors causing division. I think we have got it, have I? Yeah, causal. Development of churches in isolation. In other words, over the years and in the history of Christianity, it is a simple geographical fact. The churches grew up on the island of Patmos, on Cyprus, on the other side of the Rockies, in the Northern Peninsula, in the wilds of Tennessee, and as a result, they developed their own peculiar form of Christianity. Then when the problem arose, or question arose, of, say, playing ball or cooperating with somebody on the other side of the mountains, well, it's not the Christ we worship. Well, why are they different? You might ask. Who wouldn't be different if he was isolated long enough from his fellow man? Now you begin to see here immediately how modern times, see, demand Christian reunification. We're just too close to one another. The only option is destruction. We either destroy one another or we get together. Only two options left. Second, compulsion or persecution by a partnership of church and state to achieve, say, a particular brand or kind of Christianity. So, compulsion or pressure by a church and state combine. Now, there were times when Catholicism was guilty of that. There are times when Protestantism has been guilty of that. And in Spain, much of the prejudice against the Catholic Church is what's happened there. And in countries like Scandinavia, where there are still almost monolithic national churches, where I think in all of Sweden there are less than 25,000 Catholics after 400 years. So compulsion, in other words, then as a result, well, certain people resenting that, and you can just look to our own United States. A new brand of Christianity came on the scene because of the pressures in the then political situation in Europe. Third, discrimination. Certain groups have found themselves, as we know, within a church discriminated against on social, economic, or racial grounds. How many books you can write on that, eh? And when you so discriminate fellow Christians, you can still mouth the word fellow Christians. They don't think you're a fellow Christian anymore. They're going to organize their own church. They're going to reassess the Christianity which they believed in, past tense, before the discrimination. Fourth, secession or rejection. not infrequently, reformers, revivalists, you name them, believing themselves to be divinely called without questioning their sincerity. But there you have it. You have a Joseph Smith. You have a Mrs. Mary Eddy. You have these men and women who believe themselves to be specially inspired of God. You have, on a very high level, a man like Wesley, who believed himself to be specially enlightened by God to form a new type of Christianity that had been, say, in existence in his own Anglican community. Now, that's not theology. That's a personality believing himself, see, to have received a mystical experience. And you're going to have such personalities. The point is, what do you do about it? Here we recognize the historic fact. Fifth, reactions from unions. Now, this is a relatively modern phenomenon and has been partly created by the ecumenical movement itself. In other words, every merger, practically speaking, I don't know of a single major merger in the last 50 years in the United States, and there have been many, which has not, sadly, produced new divisions. Normally on the grounds that by uniting, you compromised. And the classic example, of course, is in the National Council of Churches in the United States. Or take the formation just a few years ago of the United Church of Christ, formed of a merger of the Congregational Christian Churches and the Evangelical and Reformed. Years of negotiation, they finally formed a brand new body which had lost the name of either of the parent bodies. That had been fought first in committees, then even in the courts, especially by the Congregationalists, who said this is contrary to our polity, as well it might be. Remember the Cambridge platform? You've got no set creed. Each church is independent. And they were told, you join up. We don't want to join up. Well, then they were told, well, what are you going to do about it? And what a question. What are you going to do about it? So they went to the courts. And the courts upheld the merger. Which meant, and this, of course, was the crucial test, they lost their churches. Once you lose that, you can hold on to all the theory you want, unless you've got a church and a rectory and the finances. You're outside the pale. And I've been in correspondence with Dr. Buckman, who was the mainstay of the opposition against the merger. For years, he fought it through the courts, he wrote endlessly, and somewhere I mentioned his name in something that I had written. He saw it, and he thought a kindred spirit. So he told me, we've ended correspondence some time ago, but at his time, at the time when he wrote, there were some 70,000 people. Perhaps, I don't know how many.